Good afternoon. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, and distinguished lecturer emeritus from York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to this July 13th, 2020 edition of Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 on the Pacifica dial, the Pacifica network, in collaboration with ycradio.org. That's right, the York College community is plugged in and tuned in to our broadcast for today. Well, today we're going to be focused on the COVID, the COVID pandemic. We're going to be talking again about the community listening line that we have to do a remix. We had a little technical problems last week, but that's okay. We're going to correct it this week. And then we're going to do a segment on the COVID-19 and institutional racism. You know, I was going off on that last week. I intend to go off on it again this week. We have joined us very shortly, Dr. Zakiya Newland, and she is the project coordinator for the Community Cares Listening Line, and Baba Leonard Dustin, President Emeritus of the National Association of Black Social Workers, and the convener of the Black Family Summit. And then Dr. Leon McDougall, President-elect of the National Medical Association, will be joining us, and we're going to have a deep conversation, a deep dive about the impact of COVID-19 on Black people. But before we do that, we just simply want to do as we always do, asking everybody to be safe. Let's be safe. Let's take care of each other. And I must say, as I go around New York, as compared to what I see in other states, it's good to see people functioning from a perspective of shared values, that we can take care of each other. The notion that it's not just about me, it's about we. It's not about me, myself, and I. It's about we, us, and our. In the African tradition, we talk about ujima, collective work and responsibility. And so, you know, if it was just about me, I could be reckless and irresponsible. I could hurt myself. But in this instance, I am potentially harming you. And so therefore, I have to take care of myself. I have to wear my mask. I have to do social distancing, not just for me. I have to do it for you. And that's because I care about you, because I care about all human beings, and that we have a shared community. And we have to do this because this virus is no joke. It is an incredibly destructive force like nothing we have seen before, at least in my lifetime. I guess the Spanish flu going back almost a century ago was maybe something comparable, but this is unbelievable. But we can get through it, and we will get through it, but we have to do it working together. So I just want to continue to stress that, as all of the programs are doing here at WBAI. Well, I want to get right now and go directly into our interview for today. And again, it's on a very powerful project. So I want to welcome again to Vantage Point, Dr. Zakiya Newland. Again, she's the project coordinator for the Community Cares Listening Line. Dr. Newland, are you there?
Dr. Daniel, so good to be here again with you and your listening audience.
All right, and also Leonard Dunstan, who is again the President Emeritus of the National Association of Black Social Workers, but also convener of the Black Family Summit. Baba Leonard Dunstan, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you, Dr. D. It's my pleasure to be with you again, my good friend.
All right, Dr. Newland, tell us what the Community Cares Listening Line is and what is its purpose.
Absolutely. So the Community Cares Listening Line is a project of the Black Family Summit, which is a program of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And the project is a culturally responsive helpline operating in our New Jersey and New York metropolitan area for first responders and essential workers of African descent. We know that they unprecedented in the impact of this COVID-19 pandemic. And so the importance of having a support line that could give emotional support and resource information was conceptualized with that specific population in mind. And so we have a series of volunteers who represent different organizations like the Association of Black Social Workers, Association of Black Psychologists, the Caribbean American social workers, as well as the Nigerian social work organization and others that have come together to support this project, help us recruit listeners for our line. That's what we call our volunteers, as well as to serve as listeners themselves in many cases. So initially, it's a helpline. We have framed it to be culturally responsive very specifically, and it really promotes the value that as a community, we do care about the impact that people are facing, and we want to be able to give support.
Babalina Dunstan, I work with you on this project, so I know a lot about it, and I'm so proud that we're doing this with the Black Family Summit. But I know you've put a great deal of emphasis on the question of essential workers. We often think about first responders, the nurses and the docs and so forth, but you have taken great pains to just stress to our community and to the world that we also just have to take care of our essential workers. Would you talk to us about that?
Yes, well, again, as Dr. Newland just indicated, Ron, we appreciate your leadership as the president of the Institute of Black World 21st Century's direction in helping us move this project forward. I would be remiss were I not to acknowledge that publicly. Secondly, I would like to commend you and your fellow colleagues at WBAI for stepping forward and helping us promote the PSA that hopefully will be running in sometime very shortly. So I wanted to make sure I said that those three things at the very outset. Now, to respond to your question, yes, I've been very adamant in pushing this notion that we need to always look at not only first responders, but also essential workers. And I kind of, in some way, lump them together. Everybody's pretty much aware of the first responders that we have come to know, as you said earlier, doctors, the nurses, and that caliber of first responders. Then they also normally associate the fire department, emergency medical services, that level of staff with being first responders. But I also want to lump in, I'm going to have it in two categories. One would be first responders, and the other would be the essential workers, which you asked me about. And I think it's kind of hard to separate the two. I'm focused, we are focused, I should say, in ensuring that members of, like, for example, MOCA 420, District Council 37, they have a very illustrious president there, Sister Carmen Charles. But the composition of her membership is primarily this level of staff that we are concerned about who oftentimes get overlooked in this pandemic. And that's the cooks, the janitorial staff, the nurses' aide, the cafeteria, other staff that complement them, such as the dishwashers, et cetera. There are others that are just as critical from our perspective. That's like, for example, Locus 370. They are primarily composed of school aides. In addition to those, other frontline workers and the like that get categorized as being essential workers would include, X-ray technicians and the like. So I'm just not limiting that group. I also, and we are also concerned about the EMS workers, that union, Local 3621, for example, represents all the EMS offices. Then you have the New York City traffic employees locals who are doing the street direction and the like, who we often neglect to mention in this category. Another category would be the Metropolitan Transit Authority. Naturally, the bus drivers, the subway cleaners, the station clerks, and the list goes on. There are a few subway clerks still left. So that's a group that we're concerned about. And naturally, the firefighters. And I want to put a specific plug, Dr. D, into the listening audience to reach out to those who know members of their own families who are members of the New York Police Guardians Association, to have them become aware of this specific project that we're talking about today. Another category would be the fire department, but the Vulcan Society. If they have family members who are members of that organization, please reach out to them. In terms of other essential workers, I always like to point out people such as the post office workers, grocery store workers, at the local supermarkets, such as Associated, and that category of staff persons, the bodega shops, the Caribbean restaurants, the continental African restaurants, especially those who specialize in foods from Senegal, Nigeria, et cetera. And we certainly cannot leave out, in terms of essential workers, UPS workers, FedEx workers, those grub delivery lunch and dinner workers. So the list could go on and on, but I think I sort of made my point that this category of staff, we want to make sure is made aware of this service. And I want to just make one last comment there in terms of the significance of the essential workers. It would be very helpful as we move this project forward, Dr. D, for our faith-based community to step up and begin to share this information hotline with their congregations, and especially those who are members of the Christian and Muslim faith.
Well, Dr. Barbara Dunston, I really think that was so important to share. And by the way, I think one of the things that you've often talked about is your appreciation for these essential workers because of some of the essential work you've had to do in your lifetime. I don't know whether you want to share that or not. I mean, you're not a stranger to having been on the front lines of doing this kind of essential work.
No, I'm glad. I'm always happy to share just a little bit. Thank you for asking me, Dr. D, about my background. Having grown up in the rural South back in the 40s and 50s, working in tobacco fields and the like, I have a keen and upfront personal experience when it comes to that level of staff who oftentimes we ignore, and especially when crises occur. My second level of experiences that I always like to share is, having lived in New York for over 52 years, I was lucky to be a part of the union movement, specifically District Council 37, where I became president of what was then called the New York City Youth Board Employees. And that opportunity had exposed me to other unions in District Council 37 and the larger New York City metropolitan area union movement. So my appreciation for the varied experiences that the union movement brings to this issue in terms of this pandemic and how their membership can be adversely impacted as a result of that is what helps to inform why this project is so significant to me personally.
And I, too, just want to just emphasize, is I think this pandemic has exposed again just how essential workers are. I mean, people take it for granted until you have a season like this. And so they're on the front lines. They have to go to work to survive, you know, in order to just make a living. And they're exposed to danger every day. And we just have to appreciate them. And in so doing, I think we need to elevate that. I mean, people are out here doing living wage campaigns and things of that nature. I hope that we now appreciate why, you know, I mean, being a essential worker does not mean you have to be paid a non-essential wage. I mean, we need people to be paid well and taken care of. And I think what we're learning and what we're seeing, and I do believe that we in the Black community have had some degree of appreciation for that. But I must say, even I have become more conscious and more aware, because we've had to become more conscious and aware of the role that essential workers play. And they're on the front line. And disproportionately, these essential workers are Black and brown. Overwhelmingly, they are that, given the nature of the inequities and disparities in American society. Barbara Dunston, I'd like you to just comment on another point, which you've already touched on, but I also wanted you to flesh it out a bit. Because clearly, the target audience is not just African Americans. You've talked about that to some degree. Why do you also place such emphasis on the diaspora, so to speak?
Well, again, Ron, and I'm going to call you Ron at this particular moment, Dr. D. It's again, having lived in New York for the number of years that I did, having worked in various capacities, not only in New York City, but for New York State, I was exposed to the various cultures that make up the African population in New York State, in the metropolitan New York City area, including Northern Jersey. As I've said on numerous occasions, New York City and the New York City metropolitan area is second only to Toronto in terms of the diversity of its African populations. I think there's something like 240 different populations that comprise the New York City metropolitan area. And within that number, there are over 75 African dialects and cultures that are represented. That includes, naturally, the Caribbean, South America, and the like. So it's critical, as we look at this pandemic, to look at the African family in its totality. And oftentimes, what we tend not to do is to recognize that there are cultural nuances that make New York City and New York City, Northern New Jersey metropolitan area very, very unique. So as you provide services for these populations, you've got to make sure that you reach out to not only listeners who understand the syntax sometimes of a caller that might call in, or there might be some other little nuances in their voice intonation that would suggest to the listener, for example, that, oh, this is a person from this country or that country. So that becomes very, very critical from my perspective. Again, having grown up in the South, but having lived the vast majority of my life in New York, it was an educational experience. The union experience that I keep referring to exposed me again to the cross-section of African people that I would have never met in my life. So when this pandemic hit, I was very just excited when you and Dr. Newland agreed that we need to advance this, because again, what we tend not to do is to look at how culturally different we are depending upon where we come from. So just to bring all of the cultures into our conversations as African people just makes me very, very proud and excited to be a part of this.
Thank you very much for that. To our listening audience, you are listening to Dr. Zakiya Newland. She is the project director for the Community Cares Listening Line. And Baba Leonard Dunstan, president emeritus of the National Association of Black Social Workers and the convener of the Black Family Summit, which is the sponsor and the convener of the Community Cares Listening Line. Now, Dr. Newland, we need to get down to where the rubber hits the road. How will first responders and essential workers access the listening line?
Absolutely. So our phone number is 877-719-1117. I'm going to repeat that a few times as I make some more comments. But again, the Community Cares listening line can be accessed by calling 877-719-1117. That is our toll-free number operating with this project. For more information, though, we have our IBW website. That's IBW21.org, as in Institute of the Black World. IBW21 is in 21stcentury.org. And on our website, we have our press release and a video announcement. And we want to make sure that people know that we are here and we are listening. That's our tagline, and it really just encapsulates the idea that there are a community of listeners who have come together to help people collectively unburden from some of the stressors and impact that this time and this pandemic is having on their lives. So the concept of well-being is critical. I'm a social worker by degree and background, and well-being is promoted in so many ways, and just by having a listening ear, someone who can hear the narrative. When you think of this idea of a listening line, it really speaks to the value of story. Everyone has a story, and we want to be able to affirm some of those stories and give support to some of those stories and be able to help people navigate some of the difficulties of whatever their stories may be at this time. So that's where the resource information comes in so handy. We recognize that this is not a therapeutic intervention. It's not a therapy line, but it is a support line because everyone needs support. It might come from having information on areas of critical need, such as some financial support or educational services, daycare services for children, services for seniors. It could be a young person who is working, but they're also supporting their family, and there's some intergenerational needs. So the resource information could be for themselves, a neighbor, a family member, whatever we can offer to give the persons that we are targeting, our first responders and essential workers, really just another aspect of being able to feel a sense of wholeness. I can imagine people driving either to work or transporting themselves on the bus or however they get to or from work and really just having a difficult day or anticipating a difficult day. That's an opportunity where they can maybe call in and get a listening ear and have some support, or maybe helping them decompress as they transition from leaving work to going home. So we want to be able to make sure people can contact us at 877-719-1117.
And what about Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram?
Yes, thank you so much for saying that. So we do have a Facebook page. We can be found at Community Cares Listening Line on Facebook, and we post a lot of information on our operations and our press announcements. We also have, through IBW, some Twitter capacity, and we're looking to build out more capacity with Instagram. So right now we are on Facebook at Community Cares Listening Line. We invite people to like the page and share the page so that people can get our information and the word can continue to be spread of this great initiative.
All right, and would you repeat that phone number one more time?
Absolutely. So it's 877-719-1117.
Now, let me ask another thing. Now, this is not just for New York, right? I think I heard Barbara Leonard Dunson say for the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area. I know that Vantage Point goes to a lot of people in a lot of areas, including Newark. In fact, I'm going to be asking the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, the Honorable Raj J. Baraka, whether he will promote this line and put it on blast, because there are a lot of essential workers, obviously, and first responders in Newark as well. So I assume it's open to everybody in the metropolitan area.
That is correct, and actually, we have to give a shout-out to our New Jersey folk who are promoting the line. We launched last week, July 6th, and the first call that we received last week was from someone in the New Jersey area, and she had heard about our listening line from her church. So I heard Baba mention earlier the importance of the faith community supporting this effort, and we do need the word to be spread through all aspects of community, and certainly our faith communities are important. So, yes, definitely New Jersey, and we look forward to hearing from persons in the New York, New Jersey metro area.
Now, finally, as I've run out of time here, you just talked about how the churches are helping. I heard Baba Linda Dustin talk about unions and all kinds of. So there are people out there now who are saying, I'm excited about this. I want to help. So there may be people who want to call because they have a need to help. There's so much domestic violence, alcoholism. There's so many things, child abuse that's taking place, that there's just a need, you know, when these things occur, it just causes difficulties that people need to respond to. And those resources will be made available to people. But if people just want to help, they said, I like what you're doing. This is an exciting idea. We thank Gary Bird. He had us on a couple of weeks ago. And he and Herb Boyd, he was excited about it. We know others who are joining in this effort. How do people who just want to help build out the Community Cares Listening Line do that?
Great. So they can contact our administrative line either by phone or email. I'll give both of those. But if they go to the IBW21.org website and see our materials, they'll get additional contact information just in case they can't write it down right now. But our phone number for administrative purposes, now this isn't the helpline. This is just our administrative operational number, is 929 356-6201. And we can be accessed by email. It's BFS, as in Black Family Summit, bfslisteningline@gmail.com. And myself, as the project coordinator and our administrative support associate, are readily responsive to emails and calls that come in. And that is a great need that we have for there to be other support. We need community cares. Community Cares Listening Line ambassadors, people who will share our message. We have materials that we could send you, that you could send out to your networks, that you could post on social media, that you can email, that you could even give out in some of your grocery stores. Or if you want to help by even recruiting listeners for us, that would be great, because we need a steady supply of our volunteer listeners, and we can share information on recruitment, training, and orientation efforts. So again, our administrative line is 929-356-6201 for more information, or an email can be sent to us at bfslisteningline@gmail.com.
And as we leave this segment, that listening line for those who want to call in, I think it's 877-719-1117. Do I have it right?
Yes, you do. That's exactly our number.
All right. And there's a slogan that says, "We're here to help keep you going," meaning while you keep everyone else going. That is such a wonderful phraseology and a sort of a familyness that is epitomized by the Community Cares Listening Line. Dr. Zakiya Newland and Babalina Dunston, thank you so much for this project, and thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you, Dr. Daniels, for having us.
Yes, and Dr. Daniels, I know that we're out of time. I would be remiss were I not to at least give a quick shout out to some folk who have been very, very instrumental. You mentioned New Jersey, and we inadvertently didn't mention the New Jersey Association of Black Psychologists as being a supporter of this project. I'm glad that the sister did talk about the caller from New Jersey. The other piece I wanted to say was that we have had excellent support from the 100 Black Men of New York City, headed by Brother Mike Garner, who is Vice President of Diversity Affairs at the Metropolitan Transit Authority. And last and certainly not least, we are moving into the potential of opening schools. So teachers are going to be very confused about some of the issues that they're going to be having to grapple with, and naturally stress will occur from that. So we want to make sure that teachers are aware that we do have within our resource bank some support services for them. And I want to thank you for hosting Dr. Mike Duke, who's going to be your next guest, who is the president, as you will introduce him, of the National Medical Association. But the significance for me is that his organization is a member of the Black Family Summit. Thank you so very much.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much. Again, we appreciate it. And again, we're partnering by we, I mean WBAI, with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and the Black Family Summit on the Community Cares Listening Line. And you'll be hearing more about it. Thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon. All right. We're going to turn the page now. And Babalina Dunston actually referenced our next guest, Dr. Leon McDougall, president-elect of the National Medical Association. He won't be president-elect for long because I think the convention is coming up. But he's already been on the job and doing such a magnificent work. So, Dr. McDougall, he's not in yet? Okay, I thought he was. Okay. All right, okay. Well, we got to keep rolling here. So while we're doing that, let me just again stress the Community Cares Listening Line, 877-719-1117. If you would like to help, you like this initiative, call 929-356-6301. Wait a minute, did I get that right? 6201, I think it is. I should have wrote it more clearly. I think I have it right. 929-356-6201 will get you. That's the administrative line for the Community Cares Listening Line. This is an incredible project. We will have the PSAs running shortly. I actually did a stab at recording a 60-second and 30-second PSA this afternoon, and we'll get it over to everything's being done virtual. I used to go out to your college and have my dear friends out there record for me, but now we're distanced. We're socially distanced, so I had to do it by Zoom, but hopefully by this afternoon or first thing tomorrow, those PSAs will be over to WBAI, and they'll start running. We are profoundly thankful to our program director, Linda Barr, for assisting with this and agreeing to do this, as well as the general manager, Berthold Reimers. This is the kind of thing that epitomizes what WBAI is about. And there's a whole range of COVID-19 programming that is being put on the air right here, so you know how to move forward. Okay, are we ready with our next guest? I don't know why he's not picking up, but if he's not picking up, let me also just begin to talk about our WBAI buddies. This gives me an opportunity because we also are still very much looking to support WBAI through sustaining contributors for WBAI. And the way you do that is by, if you're able and if you can afford it, it's $10 a month is the minimum. That's $120 a year. And there's all kind of perks that come with that, by the way, all kind of perks that go with this membership, if you will. And we need hundreds of them. And we know that there are hundreds of people out there who can afford it. There's some who cannot, because this has been devastating. But there are some of us out here who can afford it. I'm a WBAI buddy. I've been a WBAI buddy. I also contribute to the fund drives. I do everything I can to support righteous causes with whatever limited resources I have, because that's what's required, particularly at this moment of inflection. We're at a point now where we are pushing urgently in terms of bringing about the kind of changes that need to be made. And so to become a WBAI buddy, you can actually go to givetowbai.org. Give, that's the numeral to givetowbai.org. And you can just sign up. If you do it through Vantage Point, fine. But if not, you know, that's okay. It doesn't really matter to me. I mean, I would like to have you sign up for me under Vantage Point, but it's more important that it just happen. So and then you can also call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Volunteers are waiting right now to enlist you in this army, this righteous army of WBAI buddies. 516-620-3602 will enable you to become, I'm just five. I'm being very modest today. Just five people who are out there who could become WBAI buddies. Would you call? Would you please do that? And again, it's like the virus. It's not just for you. It's for us. It's for the totality of our listening community and what we do here at WBAI, including the ability to air the kind of programming like the programming we have today that's talking about the Community Cares Listening Line, and hopefully our discussion on institutional racism, if we can connect with our dear beloved brother, Dr. Leon McDougall of the National Medical Association. If not, we will definitely move on to talk about other subjects. That's the number that was given. Unfortunately, I mean, that's the number. There was another one somewhere, but that was the number that was specifically designated for today's show. So, unfortunately, apparently we're not going to be able to reach him. And that's, really wanted him to come on because he is the Black Medical Association, because that's one of the questions I would have asked him to share with the audience. There are many in the audience who know about the National Medical Association, but these are the black docs, women and men, who have made a decision that they are going to become involved in helping to work with the black community. And they've been doing that for years and years and years. Many of them went to Meharry Medical College, the storied institution that has produced so many magnificent black doctors. And I have to say that the National Medical Association, the National Nurses Association, the National Dental Association, all of these organizations, the All Healers Mental Health Alliance, the National Association of Black Social Workers, the Association of, the Administration of Black Child Welfare, all of these organizations are under the umbrella that Baba Leonard Dunstan talked about it in terms of the Black Family Summit. And when the COVID pandemic hit, we were startled that there were so many people in the Black community who thought it was a hoax. They thought it was some kind of conspiracy. They thought it was there was a melanin exception, that it would not affect Black people. All of these things were being talked about. And so Baba Leonard Dunstan sprang into action, and he convened the heads of all of these Black organizations and many more. I can remember their call very vividly. We had about perhaps 75 to 100 people on the line. And the National Medical Association stepped up and said, yes, we want to be out here disabusing people of the notion that you will not be abused by this virulent, vicious virus that has been unleashed on our community. And so they stepped up big time. And through the assistance of Mark Thompson, who is also a dear friend of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, also a member of the National African American Reparations Commission, he was able to not only have Dr. McDougall on his show, but he also helped to get some other media opportunities. And we began to see Dr. McDougall and others, you know, on MSNBC, CNN, and other channels as well. And of course, we had several people come on my show here on, and I'm sure there were other shows on Vantage Point talking about this crisis as well, as we began to get people to understand how serious and how vicious this crisis is in terms of this virus. And increasingly, we began to see the information that guess who's being impacted more than anybody else? It's Black people who are being impacted by this virus. And so, Dr. McDougall was in the front lines of helping to make that happen. So in the absence of Dr. McDougall, I am going to turn now to a subject that I really, really want to talk about today on the soapbox, as we're going to have a soapbox segment today. And I want to talk about structural institutional racism and what it looks like. Because, you know, there's a lot of conversation in the streets about this. And it's an important conversation, this inflection point that we're having around structural institutional racism. And, you know, as it relates to Black folk, we know that there are, it's like a triple damage to Black folks. First and foremost, people like Nana Patricia Newton of the Association of the CEO of Black Psychiatrists of America laid it out clear. More and more information talks about the epigenetic damage across generations that has damaged the genes of Black folks. Therefore, it's not the whole question of disparities and inequalities in and of itself that makes us, you know, more susceptible to the virus. It is that our genes have been damaged. And as a result, that creates really serious problems. And that has been passed on from enslavement on to the reality of racism in American society. And more studies are pointing that out. This is no longer theoretical or seemingly something that's conspiratorial or marginal or out there somewhere. We've been damaged. And therefore, no matter what our level, and this is being borne out, because no matter what the data is showing is, you may be a Black professional living in a comfortable middle-class neighborhood in the exurbs or the suburbs, or you may be in the hood. Black folks are still being disproportionately impacted, which means there's some underlying cause that we have to deal with. The other reality is that Black people do suffer from health and other socioeconomic disparities because of racism in this society. So today what we do see more infections and we do see more deaths in our community that data became, you know, began pretty clear. We became pretty alarmed, saying, this virus is hitting Black people harder than anyone else. And again, as I said before, you see the infections rate, you see the mortality that's happening. But there's a third factor that I really want to talk about in terms of the soapbox today, because I am really upset about this. And that is, because it adds insult to injury. We hear the whole question about deaths, the fall, sort of the falling death rate and whatnot. But here's what is not being talked about nearly enough. Is damage. Even if you get the virus and you go to the hospital and you survive, thank God, what we're seeing is you may be subject to permanent damage. Permanent damage to your heart, your brain, the cognitive system, the respiratory system, your kidneys. I mean, permanent damage. The data is showing, and they're talking about a little bit more and more now, 30 to 50% or more. 30 to 50% or more are now suffering, will suffer permanent damage. So you survive, but you're crippled, you're harmed, you're maimed. This generation, it's like lead poisoning. You know, our kids who ingested, or all of us, any of us who ingested lead, I mean, we had diminished cognitive power, IQs dropped. And even some people believe a predisposition to antisocial behavior because of what lead can do to you. So we've been suffering from that. Now check this out. This is this one. And you want to know, this is what structural institutional racism looks like. Let's go to Texas as an example. You have Governor Abbott there. And Governor Abbott, because of the movement in the street, he has a metamorphosis. He has this conversion moment where he says, oh, I now get it. I now understand the issue of police violence and police murders. The George Floyd lynching has just changed my view. And so now I am for policing and criminal justice reform. Now, quite frankly, I'm sure he's not ready to go as far as we think we ought to go in terms of defunding and dismantling this repressive system of policing we live under. And even I know some of our people in the audience get a little nervous. We're not talking about there won't ever be police. That's not the question. The question is, far too much money is being invested in the police to do harm to Black people. Why should people be stopped for, I mean, there are systems that are set up to find and ticket people, Black people, target Black people to fund their budget. This is what was happening in Ferguson. Or, you know, so many of the incidents we've seen recently, including the incident in Atlanta. I mean, this is like ridiculous. Nobody should have to die because they're sitting in a car, had too much to drink, and it's two blocks from their home. That should not happen. And so we need to dismantle a lot of the policing functions and create resources for social workers, mental health workers, violence interrupters. There are all kinds of things that could happen. It can happen. We just have to be audacious enough to believe and see that it could work. But anyway, I'm sure Governor Abbott wasn't talking about that. But he had the Holy Ghost, a conversion. He's down for it now. But check this out. Here's what I want you to see. This is what he was not for. What he did was he ignored the guidelines, the Center for Disease guidelines. He ignored them because they wanted to rush to open up business again. Martin Luther King talked about this whole question of the need for a revolution of values. That when you're talking about a capitalist, a racialized capitalist political system or a capitalist political system, period, there's an effort, there's a tendency to put profit and properties, property and machines above people, above human beings. So the same person who was talking about, I'm willing to do police reform, is wanting to rush to open up business again. ignored the CDC guidelines, the Center for Disease Control guidelines. They rushed to open it up. Well, when you rush to open it up, guess who is going to be impacted by that? Either intended or not, the people who are going to suffer, because now there's a surge, there's a spike, spiking completely out of control. Completely out of control. But guess who's suffering from that? Black people are suffering from that. On the one hand, he wants to do police reform, but he's blind, or maybe not so blind, because maybe there's a subliminal or subconscious awareness that it's just going to be black people and brown people who are going to be the ones who are being victimized by this. But even if it were not so, when you're talking about what structural institutional racism looks like, it looks like the discriminatory effect. Hear what I'm saying? The discriminatory effect. Whether he intended it or not, it had the effect of damaging black people. Or disparate impact. It disproportionately affects black people. So when you so people who don't understand structural and institutional racism, that's what it looks like. Instances, whether it's intended or not, the impact is disproportionately felt by a particular community. And in this instance, it's black people. Now, why am I angry? Because of what I just said. Because of Abbott's cavalier behavior. In fact, the behavior at the top with Agent Orange and many of these governors is criminal. They should be put in jail for criminal behavior. They are killing people by their cavalier behavior, by their omission, or in some instances, their commission. The governor, DeSantos, you know, in Florida, he's bragging, well, you thought that, you know, we opened up, and they still just opening up. That's murder. You are murdering people by your behavior. But back to Texas. What we see, therefore, is an instance where the impact on this generation are 30 to 50% of the people, black people, who will survive, but their hearts will be damaged, their brains will be damaged, their respiratory systems will be damaged, their kidneys will be damaged, they'll be crippled human beings because of the callous behavior of elected officials who frankly didn't give a damn about the impact on people of African descent. And I'm angry about that. And I think we have to speak out more loudly about that. And so I asked, you know, I'm sorry that Dr. McDougal is not here, because I want to see Dr. McDougal, and I think he'll be receptive to this. I broached the idea with Baba Leonard Dustin, the convener of the Black Family Summit. We need to call a press conference. We need to call a press conference and say this behavior, this criminal behavior, as exemplified by Governor Abbott, it is a crime against humanity. It is murder. It is criminal. It is a state of emergency for black people. That we have to, after all we've suffered from enslavement, the epigenetic transfer and damage, and now in the 21st century with the COVID pandemic and the epidemic of police murders and killings, we have to face this. This is absolutely unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable. It's a state of emergency, a state of emergency. And black folks, black leaders, women and men, organizations need to come together and demand better treatment, justice. And that justice leads down the road to reparations and a whole bunch of other things. But we can't tolerate these intolerable acts any longer. That's what structural institutional racism looks like.